So I'm going to sit. I don't know if you can see me behind the podium here sitting down, but you've been seeing me for the last 3 days, so you've probably seen enough. So anyway, I'm going to be talking about the impact of individual characteristics, family structure, and family process on educational outcomes for transition age youth with disabilities who have received SSI. And this presentation is based on data findings from the National Longitudinal Transition Study 2. So I have no financial interest in the content of this presentation. And as I'm sure many of you know, a transition to a productive adult life is an issue for all youth with disabilities. It's particularly problematic for youth with disabilities with a history of receiving SSI because they have the double disadvantage of both disability and poverty to contend with. And this is pretty well documented in the literature. Education, of course, is a critical step towards successful transition to adulthood, really for all youth these days, but certainly for youth with disabilities and no less for youth who've received SSI. So the question is, what's the relationship between the characteristics of these kids and the family and the role of family structure and family process in somehow improving, we hope, their educational outcomes? The impact of family structure and family process is not that well studied in this population, and so that's why we wanted to look at this. So the two outcomes that we're going to look at today are high school graduation and post-secondary school attendance. So college, both tech school, and when I say college, 2 or 4 year college, any post-secondary education. So the National Longitudinal Transition Study 2 is a computer-assisted telephone survey and a mail survey completed by parents and youth. Actually, I believe they sampled 11,000 people across the country, so it's a very big survey. It's the second, actually. There was one in the early to mid-90s, and this was, they did it again between 2001 and 2009. And it's families and children who are in special education and who are ages 13 to 16th in at least 7th grade on December 1st, 2000. They were randomly selected from records of local educational agencies, which are basically school districts, for lack of a better term. And it was conducted in 5 ways, so we have 5 ways of data between 2001 and 2009. In our sample of kids who have a history of receiving SSI, there were 1,826 youth. So we started with a pretty good sized sample. The kids in the sample are all ages 14 to 25, and they entered the sample in the first wave of data collection. We decided we wanted to follow kids who entered in that first wave, and that really was the vast majority of kids who were in the NLTS2. So, and they had to have reported having received SSI either currently or within the past 2 years. Most kids were receiving it currently. Just a few study limitations. There is a possible response bias due to voluntary participation of the LEAs that the school districts had the choice of participating or not, and they did a stratified sample of the school districts, which I can give you the details of if you're really interested. the other limitations, of course, this is parent report and self-report and all the kinds of issues that come up when you have that kind of reporting can come up here. Recall bias, unreporting SSI receipt, possible social desirability bias, that is people feeling that the oddest they answer a question in a certain way to please the interviewer, and other biases potentially as well. So there were 12 original disability, well, there were actually lots and lots of disability categories that the NLTS2 people collapsed into, 12 categories that mirrored what the federal government uses to categorize kids for the purposes of disability and special education. And we further collapsed those into 7 categories. And one category was learning disability, and then we created a category called other cognitive disability, and that includes autism, intellectual disability, and head injury. There's a category of orthopedic impairment, and there's a category of sensory impairment. And sensory impairment includes deafness and hearing impairment, blindness and visual impairments, and deafblind. So emotional disturbance is another category. Other health impairment, which is a category, it's a little hard to tell who's in that category, although a very interesting little piece of information I found is that actually kids with ADHD are in the other health impairment category, which surprised me, I must say. And then there's a multiple disability category. The multiple disability category was the category we used to compare kids to for the purposes of linguistic regression that we did, that you'll see here in a minute. So this is how the sample was distributed according to various individual characteristics. It was about almost two-thirds male and a third female. Whites made up about half of the sample, African Americans made up about a quarter of the sample, and Hispanics, at least in the high school completion, and those numbers are pretty similar for post-secondary education. Hispanics made up about one in five kids, and there was a small percentage of kids in other racial and ethnic categories. This is how the disability types broke down. And I think I want to sort of point out another potential limitation here. As you'll see, there are only 37 kids and 28 kids in the samples for high school completion and post-secondary education that had learning disabilities. And in special education generally, about two-thirds of kids are diagnosed with learning disabilities. And I know that there are more kids on SSI with learning. There's a higher percentage of kids on SSI with learning disabilities. I had trouble finding that exact number, but it's more than 3.8%. And even though they've weighted the data, all of this data is weighted by age and disability type. I personally have to wonder about how you can take 37 kids and blow them up into 40% of a population. Some of you may be more familiar with the magical properties of weighting than I am, but it's still something that I wish were a little different in my data set. And then, of course, there was a good representation of kids with other cognitive disabilities. Again, I would say a somewhat low percentage of kids with emotional disturbance. Kids with lots of other kinds of disabilities. Kids in these some of these other categories were oversampled a bit in order to get an adequate representation of them into the sample. A lot of kids had a secondary disability. And interestingly, most kids reported having, or their families, reported having excellent, very good, or good health. We also looked at the, quotes, number of problems that kids had. That basically means the number of functional limitations they had in terms of their physical function, their vision, their hearing, etc. And as you can see, about half the sample had three or more functional problems. The questions about the number of problems didn't ask much about the kinds of problems that might affect kids with psychiatric conditions. So we put in, for lack of a better measure, we put in social skills to try to get at that a little bit. And of course, that could affect kids with lots of different kinds of disabilities, social skills. So we put in social skills. We thought that was an important category, so we put that in as well. So looking at family process, we looked at both how involved parents are with the child's schooling, and we looked a little bit about how they interact with their kids at home, mostly about their schooling, and it was very interesting. Most parents attend their kids' parent-teacher conferences, and their kids' IEP meetings, and a fair number participated in other school functions, about half the sample. A lot of parents help their kids with homework at least one to two times a week, and parents talked to their kids quite a bit about school. And a fair number, about three quarters of the sample, also talked to their kids about their future plans. And you'll see it's very interesting how this all kind of played out. Also, as I'm sure folks here know, parental expectations play an important role in the child's educational and other outcomes. And so we also included parental expectations in terms of likelihood of getting a high school diploma and likelihood of attending post-secondary school. So, I didn't want to go, bore you with many, many, many tables and run out of time while you looked at lots of tables. So there might have been a better way to do this, but I thought one way to sort of boil things down a little bit was to tell you what was not significant in our results, and then just show you the significant results. If folks really want to know about the whole analysis, I'd be happy to share that with you, but I thought for the sake of brevity, this would be the best way to go about it. So gender was not significant, at least for educational outcomes. We did also look actually at employment, but I presented that in a poster last year, so I didn't include it this year. gender was significant for employment, but not for high school completion or post-secondary school. So race and ethnicity was also not significant, nor was secondary disability, number of problems, or social skills, which all kind of surprised me a little bit. Income was almost significant. It was borderline. It was less than 0.10, as was mother's employment. I was so tempted to have a 0.10 level of significance here because there were lots of interesting findings at 0.10, below 0.10, but I didn't for this presentation anyway. Mother's employment, though, was very close to being significant, even at the point of, very close to 0.05. In terms of the kids' individual characteristics, in terms of high school completion, the kids' disability didn't actually make much of a difference. Really, the only one that was significant, actually, I had meant just ignore what you see there, emotional disturbance. That was a 0.10. Well, significance, just ignore that for the moment. But other health was the only thing that came up as significant. And you can see that those kids in that category had a substantially lower likelihood of completing high school. But other than that, it seemed as though disability really didn't make a difference when it came to completing high school. And in a way, that's kind of encouraging because it suggests, anyway, that high schools are doing something right in terms of accommodating kids' disabilities. And making it possible for them to complete high school one way or another. Through any number of means. In terms, though, of post-secondary education, the type of disability did matter. You'll see the kids with learning disabilities were a lot more likely to participate in post-secondary education, as were kids with emotional disturbances, kids with speech and orthopedic impairments were also somewhat more likely to participate, and kids with sensory disabilities were a lot more likely. And, of course, kids in the other health category were likely as well. Kids in the other cognitive category were not more likely than kids with multiple disabilities to participate in post-secondary education. And, there are some programs now that do make it more possible for kids. There's something called thinktocollege.net. Have folks here heard of thinktocollege.net? It's a program that makes it possible for kids with intellectual disabilities to attend college, community college in Massachusetts. And I think there are other places across the country that are making it more possible for kids with intellectual disabilities to do that. But it's still a pretty new movement toward that. And so colleges, although they may accommodate folks in certain ways, have not found a lot of ways to help kids with cognitive disabilities complete those programs on a large scale. And of course, this does include, though, kids with autism and kids with brain injury. So intellectual disability is not the only thing going on here. And so in a future study, maybe I'll break it down and look at those kids, those categories separately and see what that looks like. Family structure and process, this was very interesting. A finding that was uniform across both high school completion and post-secondary education, and actually in our employment sample as well, was mother's education. The finding that mother's education leads to better outcomes for kids in terms of education, employment, health, that's a finding that you see worldwide. Just about everybody, I think it's a pretty well-settled conclusion now that educating mothers, making sure women are well-educated, has tremendous benefits for their kids. The only way in which living arrangement turned out to be significant was for kids. In high school. Kids in high school who lived either only with one parent or with one or two parents intermittently were significantly less likely to complete high school than kids in a two-parent family. That was our comparison group, which was in line with our expectations. Attending some findings that were most definitely not in keeping with what we were expecting and hoping for were that attending a parent-teacher conference did not lead to higher rates of high school completion, nor did attending, although for kids who were in post-secondary education, it did lead to better outcomes there. The two samples gave us very different results there, which I thought was interesting, and it sort of led me to hypothesize that perhaps the parent-teacher conferences are very different for the kids in the larger sample than for the kids in the post-secondary education sample. They may be talking about very different things, and there may be very different reasons for those parents to be going to those parent-teacher conferences. Attending an IEP meeting for kids in post-secondary education led to worse outcomes there. One of the takeaway messages from this slide is don't help your kids with their homework because that led to worse outcomes. I'm being a bit facetious there, but helping with homework wasn't helpful in terms of helping kids complete high school. And neither was talking to your kid. that also came up as significant in the direction of not being helpful. And I think what's really going on there, most likely, is that the kids who are getting the most help with their homework and the kids whose families are most talking to them about school are the kids who really need the most support. That's entirely possible, probably pretty likely. Something that was encouraging, though, was that if not just talking to your kid, but if you talk to your kid about their future plans, that did have a very positive impact. As you can see, it wasn't significant for high school completion, but it was very highly significant for post-secondary education, and that was a very positive outcome. So if you're going to talk to your kids, talk to them about their future plans. Don't yell at them about whatever it is they should be doing in school and they're not doing. Talk to them about life after school. And of course, parental expectations that the kid will attend post-secondary school were also highly significant. I would say those two probably go together, expecting your kid to go to college and talking to them about it. So in conclusion, disability type was an important predictor of educational outcomes, and mother's education was related to better educational outcomes for youth. Parents attending IEP meetings, helping with homework, and talking to their kid about school were negatively correlated with educational outcomes, but that may reflect a need for greater support, a greater need for support. Parental expectations about going to college and conversations with youth specifically about their future plans were important predictors of post-secondary school attendance. And, of course, further research on the impact of these factors on transitioning youth with disabilities on this assignment is needed. I really would like to know more about what these conversations between kids and their parents are like, what's going on with attendance at the parent-teacher conferences and IEP meetings. It would all be very interesting to know, and something you may not be able to get from a national survey. So I'd love to dig into that more sometime, maybe in a qualitative way. So thank you very much. Okay.